So at the beginning of our kind of time together, I would like to explain a little bit how we can practice during the sessions we have together, and also then during the kind of meditation session, because there can be, and indeed there has been, some talk of how to combine the practice which we're all too familiar with, that of mindfulness and calm abiding. How can we combine that, at least in terms of our kind of daily practice, with the topics that we learn during the various, or through the various modules of this A to Z program? And so I'd like to introduce that using the sadhana of the Buddha, this one, and just a little bit explain how to do it, so to speak. Now, as you know, when we are practicing shamatha meditation with support then refers to the visualized object, or the tangible, as it were, if you will, object. Thereupon, we place our kind of gaze, we become familiar with the image, and then we hold the image in our mind. And when we have that image clearly in mind, it's not always necessary to rely upon an external image. And as such, we rely on, or we can use, the words as encapsulated in one of these things, which is called a sadhana, which is basically a means or a way to practice a particular meditation scenario. In this treasure of blessings, what we find is simply a description of the Buddha, what it looks like. And what this does is to recall the image of the Buddha that we are familiar with from our meditation practice. So all it is, literally, is a description. And of course, we don't need to read the whole thing, because within the practice text itself, it gives us lots of reasons which are found from within the Mahayana discourses of the Buddha, the sutras, Mahayana sutras, of the reasons or the benefit, the reasons for and benefits of meditating upon the image of the Buddha. And the description, so in the page numbering is a bit strange, but if you bear with me, whether you recite this in Hebrew or English, it makes no difference whatsoever. But just for the sake of describing the practice, in my text, it begins on page 15. I'm reading the English, I guess, not the Hebrew. So if I can just explain it on this basis, and then when you do the practice in the morning, because all of you are Hebrew readers and speakers, it's much better to do the text in your native language. As such, visualize the Buddha as follows. So for a Buddhist, then, one reflects upon the nature of being a Buddhist, which is to go for refuge. And as such, there is certain recitations which are done, Namo Gurubhya, Namo Buddhaya, and so forth, which brings to mind then the objects of refuge, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha primarily, and then giving rise to the kind of altruistic intention, which is the entranceway to the Mahayana, wishing to become Buddha oneself in order to not only benefit oneself but also all beings. There within, with that is to say, motivated by those two, then we come to the actual meditation practice, within which then we read "Ah" as a magical display, the union of unborn emptiness, etc., etc. Down to visualize him as the great being who embodies the objects of refuge, which is the end of the kind of slightly larger script, the top of page 14. So that is what one should visualize. That's the description. Thereafter, what we read from the bottom of page 14, out of great compassion, etc. Of course, one should read the lesser writing, or the kind of small writing, the footnotes, if you like, which gives the benefits or teaches the benefits of meditating upon the awakened one. And from there within, as it says here, developing deep confidence in the truth of these teachings, that is to say, thinking about them, contemplating them, not just blindly accepting them or blindly kind of rejecting them, but rather taking the time and having the openness to contemplate them oneself. Thereafter we read the description of the Buddha. And when it comes down, let's see, where we have, as I pray to you, or as I supplicate you from my heart with total confidence, do not forget the great promises you made in the past. Care for us with compassion until we attain enlightenment. So for those who follow or are practicing within the various yanas of the Buddha's teaching, then it's perfectly acceptable to view one's teacher as inseparable from the Buddha, thinking of one's teacher then as the actual Buddha, appearing in this instance in the form of Shakyamuni. But the point of this exercise is to bring about the sense of trust in the Buddha as the teacher, and that serves then as a catalyst or the condition for remembering the Buddha's teachings, and also then the practice thereof. Oneself in the present moment, sitting in one's meditation cushion, as the practitioner of the Buddha's teaching. And as such, when one brings to mind the Buddha, then the sole purpose of this for us at the present moment is as a reminder, catalyst. That which it is to remind us of is the teaching itself and the putting into practice thereof. Now, when we read the kind of supplication which is on the top of page 12, which is there in Tibetan and also in English and presumably Hebrew as well. Guru, a teacher, Bhagavat, Tathagata, Arhat, perfect Buddha, glorious conqueror, Shakyamuni, I submit obeisance to you, I make offerings and I take refuge. It's said that one should recite that three times. And the reason for having Guru at the beginning before teacher is within the kind of practice of the Mahayana, and in particular then the Vajrayana, there is the method of seeing the teacher as the actual Buddha, and the reasons for it are given, and the logic is therein laid out. And as such, some people tend to assume that kind of the Buddha is something, you know, 2,500 years, over 2,500 years ago, something which is a little bit difficult to kind of make a connection with. So here, if one remembers that one's teacher is the actual embodiment of all the Buddhas of the 10 directions and three times, that is to say, each and every Buddha is the embodiment of every other Buddha appearing in one aspect, or in certain cases, in myriad aspects. If one relates then to one's teacher as the Buddha in person, it brings Shakyamuni closer to us, makes a stronger connection. And as such, when we think of the so-called historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, if one understands that the nature of Buddha, if one understands the nature of a teacher or guru in this instance, one easily understands then the inseparability thereof. And this is something that we'll be discussing in the next couple of days. But for the time being, for those of you who have Mahayana, in particular Vajrayana guru or master, then it's essential, in order to enhance and deepen one's practice of seeing then the teacher as the possessed of or embodying the enlightened qualities, to then, when one visualizes Shakyamuni Buddha, to think of Buddha then as just a particular manifestation of one's own enlightened teacher's activity. And as such, one places one's attention upon the object, and just in the moment then, one lets it rest there, and when one finds the mind or one's attention wandering away from the object, at that point one brings the mind back, one brings your attention back and refixes it, readheses it to the object through using mantra. The mantra here then is the name mantra, so-called, of Shakyamuni Buddha. And it is said that this particular recitation is extraordinary. This is the mantra, the very mantra that Shakyamuni Buddha, whilst on the Bodhisattva path, became enlightened upon. And it is said that I heard from one of my teachers, Thukpemo Wangyal, who heard from Kunalama Rinpoche Tenzin Gyaltsen, who was a teacher of the Dalai Lama, that even through reciting this mantra one time, it destroys 80,000 aeons worth of negative karma. And Thukpemo Wangyal kind of clarified that, saying, you shouldn't kind of think, well, I recited it once, how come there's no special sign? Maybe it's not true. But if we consider, as we've done in the past, where we are at the present, where we've come from and where we're going, that is to say, past and future lives, and when one considers the inconceivable numbers of inconceivable or uncountable aeons that one has been within samsara, then 80,000 countless aeons is nothing. It's just like, it's like a kind of a microsecond in this lifetime. So as such, it doesn't mean that just because there's no instant sign that the practice isn't working. It rather means that one should kind of put more effort to the practice. Again, if one is excited, one brings the attention back to the object through using the mantra. That's what it's there for. That's its purpose. If one finds oneself dulling down, kind of falling asleep, you can turn the light on. Or, as the sadhana then goes on to describe, from the body of the Buddha shines a great light of multicolored rays of wisdom light, dispelling the obscurations of myself and all sentient beings, perfecting the qualities of the Mahayana path and establishing us on the level of a non-returner. So through this brightening, that is to say, increasing the radiance of the object, one lifts oneself up. That is to say, one turns back the kind of dullness or the kind of dimming of mind by brightening the image held within the mind's eye up. Now, as a preliminary to the discussion we're going to have over the next couple of days, I would suggest that after having read the description, recited the mantra a little bit, allow yourself just to settle down, focusing upon the image, not allowing your mind to wander, holding your mind upon the image, being very open, very mindful, allowing a kind of clarity of vision, that is to say, clarity of mind, to arise from within. And within that clarity, then, if we look towards the heart of the Buddha, and therein we view Manjushri, who is the embodiment of all the Buddha's wisdom, and looks like that, the one with the sword. It's a kind of very, very deep, kind of ready orange in color, brilliant like the settings, like the sun. Vividly clear, but extremely bright. And this is the embodiment then, or the personification, if you will, of all the Buddha's wisdom. And as all the masters of the past have suggested, that when we're engaging in the practice of hearing and contemplating, and before meditating, it is always useful to invoke the personification of wisdom as a means or as a cause for us to develop said wisdom ourselves. Recently I heard Isona Siddhartha Lama telling the school children at the TCV that when he was a young man, he received this particular, exactly what we're going to read here, and he did a little retreat on it, reciting this praise to Manjushri known as Kangyi Lodro, again and again and again. And he said he definitely felt, even within a short space of time, that his wisdom or his ability to comprehend what he was learning greatly increased. And as such, we have we have exactly the same we have exactly the same method in front of us, and as such, there's no reason why we ourselves cannot give rise to such extraordinary levels of wisdom as His Holiness has. We have exactly the same method. And this particular praise to Manjushri is written here, popularly known as Kangiludra. So Kangiludra is the opening kind of line of this particular praise. But there is a title which is called Yeshi Yuntin Sangpo. And this is a name, it's somebody's name. And according to our teacher, Gaji Kamtrul Rinpoche, the history of this particular praise is quite unique in the sense that the abbot Yeshi Yuntin Sangpo of Nalanda Monastery in ancient India, so around maybe the 1st, 2nd century AD, requested the kind of top scholars of this Buddhist university, which housed in thousands, tens of thousands of really learned individuals, monastics. He asked them all he asked about 50 of them, the kind of top scholars, to compose a praise to Manjushri. And they all went back to their kind of respective cells and meditated upon Manjushri. And when clarity of mind came, within that kind of clarity, it is said that each and every one of them received the blessing of Manjushri and composed exactly the same praise. And as such, it is said, or is commonly taught within the Tibetan settlements, that this particular praise is none other than the expression of Manjushri himself. And as such, to recite this brings about exceptional wisdom. Thereafter, there is the... Now, when we talk about the personification of, for example, in all the Buddhas of compassion, genesig, ability or capacity or power, if you will, Vajrapani, and in this instance, wisdom, the Buddha's wisdom is not limited by appearing as personified in form, that is to say, kind of the form of Manjushri. It also can appear in the form of sound, smell, taste, etc. As such, then, all of the Buddha's wisdom appearing as sound appears as the form of the mantra, Arapasanadi. And as such, then, one is advised when engaging on intellectual kind of pursuits or contemplative activity to recite this mantra 100 times or something, and in particular, towards the end of one's recitation, to recite the seed syllable, di, which is all of the Buddha's wisdom appearing in the form of a sound, di. And as such, one is advised to recite that a number of times. Thereafter, there is a short kind of supplication to Manjushri, which we read here on page bottom of page 9, conclusion. You who are loving kindness and radiate the light of knowledge, etc., clear away the darkness of my ignorance completely. Please give me the knowledge and ability to understand all of the teachings of the Dharma. And as such, when we make that kind of when we make that kind of request, you think that the light goes on in your head and all the darkness or confusion has gone away. And then just sit in that kind of notion. When you're doing this recitation, if you're able to, at the same time as holding images within your mind, do the kind of practice of various visualization techniques, think that the image of Manjushri kind of becomes brilliant and sends kind of light to you. And here then the light doesn't need to be in a particular size or a particular shape. Just think of the sun's rays. When we talk of the sun, the rays of the sun, that's only when the clouds are in a certain way do we see kind of shafts of light, and then we can say the rays of the sun. But sunlight is with us continually. It doesn't have a particular kind of shape. It doesn't have a particular form, but we know it's there because we feel its warmth, as do the kind of flowers who kind of open and reveal their beauty in front of its warmth. Similarly, when sitting in front of visualized deities which have the practice of extra kind of visualized practices, such as radiating of lights which dissolve into you, etc. Here, one doesn't need to think that they're kind of like, like in the Star Trek film, it's a kind of laser bolt and it kind of hits you in a certain place. And if it doesn't hit you there, it goes somewhere else, and then you don't really receive the kind of blessing or spiritual boon that you want, etc. Just think of the light radiating from Manjushri like as the sun's rays. It doesn't have a particular shape or form. It pervades everywhere and brings about the awakening of one's wisdom. And therewith, recite the mantra a few times. At the end of that, return to visualizing the form of the Buddha, resting one's attention there, and just let the kind of clarity of mind come to the forefront of your experience. And within that clarity of mind, just settle down. And therein, we can, if we are going to contemplate the teaching that we are going to discuss, then just think about it. Not in a kind of really, really kind of elaborate way, but here, the example is of hammering a nail. If you put a nail in some wood, you just continually bang on the head until you kind of have knocked it through. So similarly, when we contemplate on a particular subject, we should, during the time when we're studying it, during the time when we're kind of talking about it with our friends or discussing it with our friends, we should use as many kind of lines of reasoning, as many kind of quotations as possible, get as broad a picture as we can. But when it comes to self-contemplation, trying to take the kind of object, that which we've gained certainty about, and subjectify it, Kepje Dochang, Dema Lutsu Rinpoche, always advised me that when you're engaging in the practice of studying the texts, you should make it as vast as possible. But when it comes to actually contemplation, you should take everything you know and condense it to something really, really small, but that which is very, very potent for one, which invokes a particular feeling or a particular knowledge within one. And it's that you should use to bring about a change within one's being. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all have the time to study and to contemplate, you know, countless numbers of books, teachings, what have you. Nevertheless, masters of the past have done that for us. And if we're just to read a few key texts, thereby honing in on the essential kind of outline, looking at how the texts fit together, thereby we can condense the meaning of those few texts into, and this doesn't need to be in Tibetan or English, it can be in whatever language you feel comfortable with, gaining a few kind of lines or a few lines of reasoning, a few quotations, and just repeating them again and again, subjecting them to one's analysis, thereby drawing out a certainty with regard to the subject that one is studying, or in this instance, contemplating. And when one really feels that certainty from within, then one just rests and allows that certainty to kind of be absorbed within us. And then after a while, when the usual thought proliferation occurs again, we go back to the kind of investigation of the subject, using the same object, a particular line of reasoning or quotation, and working on it again and again and again, and thereby bringing about the subjective transformation of one's mind in line with the kind of teaching, which is or to be digested by one through one's own kind of the use of one's intellect, through the use of one's knowledge, through the use of one's logic, etc. Here one is not just simply reciting something to kind of brainwash oneself, far from it. Here one is learning a subject so as to then bring about the transformation or the changing of one's mind independence thereupon. And as such, we don't want to kind of just, as we hear in the meditation teachings, give our nose ring to just anyone. Similarly, when it comes to the practice of contemplation, we don't just want to take what somebody says as being the truth. Here, we need to subject that which we are looking at through using our intellect, through using our kind of logic, through using lines of reasoning, etc. And as such, to be open to that, to create the space within which to do that is extremely important. As such, through the practice of mindfulness, through having lifted up our spirit, recalling the teacher, having then given rise to a sense of clarity and invoked the kind of Buddha's wisdom through the practice of Manjushri, within the clarity therein, left thereby, we're going to bring to mind the subject that we are going to analyze or we're going to contemplate, and just focus upon that without allowing our mind to kind of wander off. If we do find ourselves wandering off, like with the teachings on Shamatha, we bring it back to the object. If we do find ourselves falling asleep, again, like with the teachings on Shamatha, increase the brightness of the image, stand up, you know, if you are at home, wash your face, go to a high place, stand in the wind, etc. These are all methods that we know through then having practiced mindfulness and in particular through practicing Shamatha. But however, in this instance, when we're going to get together, the meditation session, I don't know how long it is, but therein if one can just recite this in an abbreviated way, then there is the period of contemplation. At the end of said period of contemplation, then the kind of dedication as usual, and then the closing of this sadhana is found at the bottom of page 11, where we read the miraculous display of the unsurpassable wisdom appears as the intentions, deeds, etc. And as such, we read that and then conclude by, as usual, taking the image of the Buddha and kind of dissolving it either into emptiness or allowing it to then come to the crown of one's head, so that we can carry on the practice of mindfulness. In particular then, the mindfulness of not only the Buddha, but mindfulness of the Buddha's teaching throughout the day. As in the meditation, which is the schoolmaster and the naughty school child. So this then is how I would like for our kind of practice to go, if you wouldn't mind. And so, Venerable Tekchok is the chanting master, so I'll request him to do in Hebrew and or whatever language you like. Hebrew is okay? Okay. Page 15. Yeah. As a magical display, the union of unborn emptiness and the unceasing manifestation of interdependent origination. Visualize in front of one infinite clouds of offerings in the sky, in the middle of which, upon a jeweled lion throne, lotus, sun and moon, is the incomparable teacher, Lion of the Shakyas. The color of gold, endowed with the major and minor marks, wearing the three Dharma robes and seated in the Vajra posture. His right hand is in the gesture of touching the earth. His left hand, in the mudra of equanimity, holds an alms bowl filled with nectar. He shines in splendor and majesty like a golden mountain, his wisdom filling space in a plexus of rays of light. He is surrounded by infinite retinues, host of exalted beings, the eight close sons, the 16 Shravakas, and the like. On those who merely think of him, he bestows complete liberation from the two extremes of samsara and nirvana, the glory of supreme bliss. Visualize him as the great being who embodies all objects of refuge. Out of great compassion, you took care of this world of degeneration and strife and made 500 great prayers of aspiration. You are praised as the white lotus. Whoever hears your name will not return to samsara. Compassionate teacher, I submit obeisance to you. The wealth and accumulation of merit of body, speech and mind of myself and others, I offer, visualizing them as a Samantabhadra cloud of offerings. All of the negative actions and downfalls that I have accumulated since beginningless time, without exception, I confess individually with strong, heartfelt regret. I rejoice in the merit accumulated in the past, present and future by exalted beings and ordinary beings. The wheel of Dharma of the profound and the vast teachings, I request you to turn uninterruptedly in the 10 directions. Although your wisdom body, like the sky, remains without changing throughout the 3 times, according to perception of beings, you demonstrate birth and death, yet may you appear in the Namakaya form forever. Through the merits I accumulate in past, present and future, in order to benefit all beings whose number fills space, may I constantly gladden the King of Dharma and attain the level of the Conqueror, Lord of the Dharma. Through your kindness, compassionately caring, especially for us unprotected beings of this degenerate age, whatever appearance there is of the 3 jewels in this world at this time is your enlightened activity. You are the only incomparable and sublime refuge. As I pray to you from my heart with total confidence, do not forget the great promises you made in the past. Care for us with compassion until we attain enlightenment. Lama tomba chomden de tishin sheba drajomba yanda brozobe sange pelgyawa shakya tubala chasalo chudu kebzu chiyo. Guru teacher Bhagavat Tathagata Arhat Perfect Buddha Glorious Conqueror Shakyamuni, I submit obeisance to you, I make offerings, I take refuge. Guru teacher Bhagavat Tathagata Arhat Perfect Buddha Glorious Conqueror Shakyamuni, I submit obeisance to you, I make offerings, and I take offerage. Tayadar Om Muni Muni Mamanaiso. 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 Then we turn to page 9 in the English, visualizing Manjushri in the heart of the Buddha. Homage to the Lama and Lord Manjugosha, your wisdom is brilliant and pure like the sun, free from the clouds of the 2 obscurations. You perceive the whole of reality exactly as it is, and so you hold a book at your heart. You look upon all the prisoners of samsara who are suffering with the love of a mother for her only child. Your enlightened speech has 60 melodious tones. And like the thunderous roar of a dragon, you wake us from the sleep of disturbing emotions and free us from the chains of karma. Dispelling the darkness of ignorance, you wield the sword of wisdom, ready to cut through all our suffering. Pure from the very beginning, you have reached the end of the 10 bhumis and perfected all enlightened qualities. The foremost of the Buddha's heirs, you are adorned with 112 marks of a Buddha. To Manjugosha, the gentle voiced, you who dispel the darkness of my mind, I prostrate. Arapatsana di ni 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 ni. You who are loving kindness and radiate the light of knowledge, clear away the darkness of my ignorance completely. Please give me the knowledge and ability to understand all the teachings of the Dhamma. And so, I'd just like to say a couple of things at the beginning of our time together concerning the course that we are all kind of embarked on. This thing called Buddhism A to Z. I'd like to just clarify a couple of things concerning the nature of the course, the way it's laid out. So if you have problems with the layout of the course, then I'm the one to blame, because it's my kind of construct. I was asked a number of years ago by some friends, what is the best way that one can bring about kind of change within oneself? Some people may call this, according to Buddhist technical terms, kind of spiritual realization. What's the best way that we can actually experience this for ourselves? Now, I mean, all the books talk about it, and when you see various teachers, such as Zonas Dalai Lama and others, they seem to have some particular quality, and maybe we'd like to have that quality. And so the question was brought about, how do we actually bring this about within us? Because there, within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition in particular, there are, you know, what are known as the kind of the 10 great treatises, the 8 chariots of spiritual kind of accomplishment, the 4 different traditions, and some of those have varying subdivisions with varieties of teachings, each one seemingly more kind of spectacular than the next. So the question is, which one to do? They all seem so lovely and so amazing, and I'm sure they are. But just as if we let a child loose in a chocolate shop. Venerable Thekchot took me once in the old city, right, to a chocolate shop there. And I was just imagining if you kind of put my niece or nephew in that place. There's all this kind of chocolate in massive, kind of huge amounts everywhere. And they would just go nuts, probably for about half an hour, and then they'd pass out from sugar overdose, I'm sure. And similarly, when we, as a beginner, particularly within the kind of Tibetan Buddhist tradition, when we see all these books, all these different, you know, pictures of people and deities and all these different meditation practices and scenarios, and they all, you know, if we just take one of them, it tastes very nice, it gives us some satisfaction. But if, you know, like particularly my niece in a kind of chocolate shop, kind of eating everything, you know, passes out with kind of chocolate smeared all over her little face, what would you have accomplished that? Probably vomiting on the pavement outside the shop as you're kind of carried away. So how do we set ourselves such that we're able to enjoy everything? Now, we would say that the reason a child kind of goes nuts in a sweet shop is because they don't have any restraint, whereas certain elder people may exhibit some kind of restraint, because they know, for themselves at least, the potential kind of danger of overeating sweet things. And as such, they may just take one or two pieces and enjoy that, and then go on to something else. So there's a notion of kind of restraint, which is kind of logically founded, in the sense that one knows one's kind of limitations, whereas a child is, for any kind of amount of chocolate, is willing to kind of do almost anything. So as such, when it comes to the kind of practice of the teaching of the Buddha, what I said at the time to these friends, it requires a thorough grounding in the general kind of teaching of the Buddha. And with a thorough grounding in Buddhism, if you like, Buddhism in general, if you will, then wherever one chooses to go, that grounding will accompany you. For example, if you thoroughly ground yourself within the Tibetan tradition, and then you decide that, you know, Zen is really your thing, that grounding will only support that Zen practice. Similarly, through grounding oneself in the Tibetan, Tibetan tradition, or let's just say the Mahayana Sutra tradition, that in and of itself, if you choose to practice the kind of Pure Land tradition of China and Japan, again, this will serve you well as your foundation. Similarly, within the Tibetan tradition, if you go on to more advanced meditation practices, whether they work or not depends on how grounded you are within the general teaching of the Buddha and the general kind of Mahayana Buddhism teachings. This then provides the ground or the foundation, independence upon which one can really appreciate and kind of extract the essence from these seemingly higher practices. Otherwise, without a grounding, without a foundation, we may even trick ourselves into thinking that we're engaging in practicing these seemingly higher teachings, whatever they may be. But the reality is that we're on kind of shaky ground. And when difficult circumstance comes along, we notice that our practice goes to pieces. Or we panic and we look to something else for support. If genuine practice has occurred, or we've engaged in genuine practice, then we should have the confidence that comes from that. And this kind of threefold confidence, that is to say, objectively understanding the meaning of the Buddha's teaching. Understanding that is said to be then, to use the technical language, the wisdom that comes through studying the teaching. An objective understanding, a theoretical understanding, if you will, of a particular subject. Now, of course, there's a dichotomy between a theoretical understanding and oneself. So then one has to bring this home. And that digesting process is what is known as contemplation. And until when do we contemplate a particular subject? We contemplate it until we're absolutely convinced of it with ourselves, using ourselves rather, as the basis. So for example, when we consider reflecting upon mortality, impermanence, as you've all done, I'm sure, within that contemplation, objectively, it's relatively easy to understand, as long as it's somebody else who's passing away. It's very easy then to reflect upon the three or the nine kind of ways to kind of think about impermanence or change. However, with regard to ourselves, the attitude can be somewhat different. The understanding remains objective, but it doesn't hit home. As such, the point of the teaching is completely lost. For the point of reflecting upon impermanence is to kind of put one in a position where one is not wasting one's life. As the Buddha himself mentioned in one of the discourses, maybe Rice Seedling Sutra, that of all the greatest imprints left in the mud, that of the elephants is the deepest. And similarly, the deepest of all contemplations is that of impermanence. For it is the reflection upon, or contemplation upon, one's demise, one's ultimate demise, or one's mortality, one's changing nature, changing moment from moment to moment. It is this reflection that not only drives one towards seeking an end to being under the influence or under the kind of control of this kind of continuity of rebirth, which is known as samsara, which is we are therein kind of thrown here and there through the force of engaged karma, which arises through then these wrong perceptions, primarily of grasping upon that which is void or empty of autonomous existence as having autonomous existence, grasping upon or becoming addicted towards, on a kind of mediocre level, that which is ultimately unable to bring any lasting satisfaction as having an enduring satisfaction or a quality of enduring satisfaction, and on a basal level, kind of grasping onto the difficulty that arises in the action which is engaged under the influence of grasping upon that which is impermanent as being permanent and enduring. And the primary object of said contemplation is oneself. That even though we recognize the mortality, you know, our friends and family members, people we know, people we like, people we dislike, etc., when they pass away around us, then this is a, of course it's a sign that all kind of living things come to an end. But here, how much does that affect us? How much does it motivate and then drive our kind of contemplation, our practice? Here then, there is a strong dichotomy between having an understanding, an objective understanding, and having a kind of subjective, experiential understanding of said subject matter. As such, in order to kind of bring that home, one understands logically the meaning of impermanence, of one's mortality, over there, as it were, objectively. And then one changes the subject, changes it from another to oneself, and again uses the same lines of reasoning and reflects upon one's mortality. And one will find during this contemplative process that there is a huge difference, because it's very easy to accept somebody else's mortality, but our own mortality is something which we don't really or readily want to accept and acknowledge. And that's because then we've kind of put blinkers upon ourselves, so that we don't recognize that fundamental feature about ourselves. And as such, to this contemplative process then of recognizing just the simple nature of change with ourselves as the subject matter is that which comes about through the practice of contemplation. One reflects upon this time and time again until one is absolutely convinced of one's mortality. It doesn't mean that, you know, like for example, where I'm from in England, if you meet the superstitious people, they always say, oh, you should never think about mortality. You should never even mention the word death. Why? Because it invites death into your house. Utter nonsense. I've said I've won the lottery hundreds of times, but I've still never bought a winning ticket. So similarly, contemplating on this in a very open, kind of scientific, if you will, kind of way, just to look at the nature of things. This then brings about the certainty in one's mortality. It doesn't mean that one is going to die tomorrow. That's just absolute nonsense. It rather means that one is just aware of the possibility of one's mortality. What is the benefit then? Is that if one suddenly has to die, one is prepared for that. If it catches us unaware, then we're not prepared, then difficulty can ensue at the time of death, as I'm sure you're aware through your contemplations, through your studies. As such then, when this conviction arises, the conviction of one's mortality arises within us, it's then up to the practice of familiarizing ourselves with that, to the point that it transforms the way we view, or the way we kind of look at the world. And this is brought about through the practice then of meditation. And from within the two types of meditation, it's brought about through analytical meditation. And analyzing then one's mortality in this example, so this kind of certainty arises from within us. And then with a single-pointed contemplation, we hold that within our mind. And slowly what we notice is that what starts to crumble away is a notion of kind of rejecting one's mortality. And as such, through familiarity, then the realization or the understanding that one is kind of mortal, and at some point or another, one is going to pass away. This impermanence comes to the forefront of our being, and thereby, as many of the kind of leading artists, poets, therapists, and of course Buddhist masters have said over millennia, is that when one has an appreciation of mortality, one lives one's life to the full. So as such, this is a kind of sign that one's practice is going kind of on the right level, when one's attitude starts to change through then the meaning of method of analyzing and then single pointedly holding one's mind upon this certainty or this kind of truth that one has kind of discovered within oneself. Now, this depends upon For this, this realization is called, and the wisdom which has arisen through meditation. Now, when we notice within what I'm mentioning to you, there are two things. There is the threefold wisdom which comes about through understanding something objectively, then contemplation, and then meditation. So we need two things. One is an understanding of the subject matter, and secondly is a strong kind of mindfulness, at best then a kind of single-pointed awareness or attention, sustained attention, where we can, like banging in a nail, we can repeatedly bang on the head of the nail so as to drive it into the wood. Similarly, through having investigated on a fundamental level and come to an objective certainty about a subject, we can then subjectify it, understanding it subjectively. Then through repeated familiarity or meditation, one brings this kind of truth home, and thereby what we reject is this false kind of sense of security, which is a complete farce, grasping onto then the fact that we ourselves are not changing, which on a basal level we know to be untrue, but in order to kind of protect ourselves, we build this cocoon around ourselves. And as such, then, in order to knock this down, one needs not only a correct understanding of the subject, in this instance, the simplest example of impermanence, but also, in addition thereto, one needs a strength of mind, which isn't kind of wandering off. Just imagine literally trying to bang in a nail and your kind of hands going like you're blindfolded. You may harm yourself. You may hit yourself with the hammer. You may just kind of damage that which you're trying to knock a nail into. But the chances are slim that one will continually hit the nail's head. Similarly then, when it comes to practice on the basal level, on the foundation of the spiritual approach, of the Buddhist spiritual approach, one needs then a firm foundation in both the theory, and then slowly one begins the kind of subjectification of that, and then finally one then meditates upon it. As such, a number of years ago, when Dharma friends asked me about this, they asked me to give an opinion of what had been, what Dharma friends had accomplished over the years that it had been going, however many years that was, I can't remember. But I mentioned that I thought what they'd accomplished is really, really wonderful, really admirable. And so they went on to say, but what do you think we could do to improve the way of things? And so I simply said, how many people with genuine kind of spiritual experience do you have? And of course, it's very difficult to say because it's something very subjective, isn't it? But are there one or two who are able to kind of speak well, have some qualities that are kind of spoken of in the Dharma? And they said, oh, well, you know, And I said, it's nothing to be kind of upset about in one way, because this is something that everybody has experienced before, particularly in Europe, where there are a number of, you know, and North America as well, where there are a number of Buddhist centers. Some have resident teachers, some have visiting teachers, some have both. And the teachers that come, they kind of give a course on this, course on that, course on something else. And it's very confusing for the student to actually kind of get a hold on how to actually digest all the teachings that are thrown together. Well, within the kind of Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, they will say, oh, it's easy, just understand the Lamrim. But the Lamrim is not a beginner's text. The Lamrim is a meditation manual which is intended for somebody who has a very good knowledge of Buddhism. And as such, for a couple of decades, there were a number of our friends were kind of floating around a little bit. You have a good knowledge of a lot of things, but there's nothing to kind of string them kind of all together. And as such, I reflected on how His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when he gives teaching in particularly, well, actually in Asia as well as in the West, he always says, and in an interview I read as well, he said that when somebody asked him with regard in the Lamrim, etc., it begins straight off with kind of relying on the spiritual friend. But, you know, for certain Westerners, that's not applicable. What do you think about that? And his Holiness said, I completely agree. That's why I always, if I have the time, I try to give a basic overview of the Buddhist teaching in its entirety, and on that basis introduce then the graduated stages of the path. Similarly, within kind of Tibetan institutions, in the Tibetan communities, lamas of this Lamrim tradition won't teach it to just anybody, because they understand how the person who wants to practice this method should have a grounding in the Buddhist teaching in general. And as such, if somebody went, you know, to see a teacher and said, please can you teach me, the teacher then would, again, assessing the capacity of the student, would either teach them slowly through the medium of meditation, or kind of slowly through the medium of kind of classes, leading them to the point of meditation. But nevertheless, they would teach them according to their kind of needs. They wouldn't necessarily say, okay, we're going to teach a text, and if you don't understand it because you've got no grounding, tough. Why? Because the text said so. If one is teaching a text in such a manner, then one is a very kind of frivolous and very kind of not a very kind of caring teacher at all. As such, the necessity to have a foundation is imperative. And again, if I go back to the way things were in Tibet, when one goes to one's teacher for experiential meditation instruction, now here you have to understand that a monastery or a nunnery is not necessarily a retreat center. A retreat center is a place where you literally kind of go away from the kind of hustle and bustle, and you concentrate on inner development in a very quiet and secluded area. A monastery is where monastics live, and they do particular activities. The monastic male or female, monks or nuns, it makes no difference. There's a particular routine to the establishment, and there's usually a kind of a very rigorous study program. And the idea is that there you become learned, there you become skilled in teaching. Then you go to a kind of a lonely kind of retreat place, and you gain inner kind of development. And then thereafter, it's up to you whether you spend your life in the caves practicing, like Milarepa did, or whether you go back and you teach in the institutions that you've come from, or you go to a different branch institution and teach and practice there. It really makes no difference. But it's essential to understand that within the kind of monastic college, or shedra as it's known nowadays, therein the primary activity is to learn the teachings of the Buddha. This then is the foundation, and it's in dependence upon this wisdom coming from hearing and some contemplation, that one is able then to, if it suits one, to go away and to practice. But nevertheless, when it comes to the digesting of the teaching itself, even though we've received kind of countless countless discourses on the particular subject matter, the ability to digest that, the ability to meditate upon it well, comes then through seeking out a teacher of meditation, and through relying upon that teacher, listening to his or her discourse, listening to what we'll call his or her kind of pith instructions. Because the greatest meditation teacher is the one who is able to look at everything and just pull out what is essential to you. Now, this may not be obvious to you in the moment, but nevertheless, as Kevjo Rinpoche, Demalojin Rinpoche mentioned when he gave one particular instruction, which is called the how to do, if you will, the raw or naked instructions of the graduated stage of the path, or the Lamrim. Therein, Rinpoche would always mention a particular example of a Tibetan doctor. Now, a Tibetan doctor is a herbalist, and a Tibetan doctor, if we can, again, maybe I should explain. Nowadays, if we go to a Tibetan doctor, they will take our pulse and they will give us pills from a shelf. Now, they've probably made these pills. Let's say, for example, the 35 compound agar pill, which is used for curing stress. So there are 35 compounds in this pill, and usually a doctor will take the pill off the shelf and they'll give it to you and say, take two before you go to bed. In Tibet, it was different. A genuine kind of doctor in a kind of a clinic would have a number of powders, rather like in the Chinese. Now, I don't know in this part of the world, but if you go to China, in a traditional herbalist's clinic, there'll be walls and walls of herbs. And you'll go in and he or she, the doctor there, will take your pulse. They'll look at your tongue, look at your eyes, maybe even look at your urine. And then they will select the herbs which not only deal with your particular ailment, but also are in tune with your particular constitution. And they'll give you a bag of herbs, and then you just partake of that. Similarly, a Tibetan doctor, they'll have all of the kind of herbal powders in their clinic. You'll go to them, they'll take your pulse, they'll read your tongue, urine, etc. And then they will make a compound for you based upon your illness, which you'd like to be cured of, and also taking into consideration your constitution. Now, there are two types of doctor. There's the one who can do the pulse reading, who can make the compound, and can also wander off into the woodland and pick all the barks and grass and herbs and roots, etc., that are needed. They can also prepare the medicines therefrom. They can prepare the compound and give it to you. And there is also another type of doctor who can prepare the compound. He cannot go out wandering around here and there, but he just knows how to kind of put two and two together. And then there's ourselves, the patient, who pretty much have no idea about how Tibetan medicine works. We've got no clue as to what the different herbs, grasses, barks, etc., that go into the compound, what they are like, what they look like, what they smell like, what they taste like even. But nevertheless, if all three of us become ill with the same, let's say, stress-induced illness, the medicine for us all is the same. It's a 35 compound agar pill. And as such, when it comes to meditating on one point, if you know everything, you're still meditating on the same point. If you know partially everything, maybe half of everything, it's still the same point. And if you know nothing about that, but you just received meditation instruction from the teacher, it's still the same point that you'll be meditating upon. So, for example, the pith instructions that one receives from a teacher, which are written down nowadays, known as the kind of naked instructions or raw instructions or how to do instructions, are then delivered to us or given to us by somebody who's realized them or has actualized them, not only as a kind of objective understanding, but rather through deep spiritual contemplation, which makes them kind of heavy with the quality of that particular contemplation. And is able then to give it to us in such a way that we're able to take it, partake of it, and become cured of our particular ailment. Now, if I'm suffering from stress, then the medicine that would kind of alleviate bile not only wouldn't help me, but it would actually be detrimental for my kind of well-being. So similarly, when one receives or when one goes to a meditation teacher, the teachings in general are tailored to the student, just as in the old tradition of Tibet, a compound, if I'm suffering from stress and a friend is suffering from stress, based upon our differing constitutions, the medicines that we may be given are completely different. So similarly then, when the meditation instruction is given, it's usually given one-to-one, and then there's a dialogue with a meditation instructor. Now, in order to really benefit from an interaction with a qualified teacher, one needs a kind of grounding in the general teaching of the Buddha. In order to bring about this kind of general grounding, we then put together this kind of course called Buddhism A to Z. And the idea of the course is to present a gradual kind of dissemination of the general and specific teachings to Mahayana Buddhism as presented within the Tibetan tradition. And as such, when we kind of laid the foundation of the course, when we kind of devised it together, the idea is that every module serves as a foundation for that which is to come. As such, then there are some kind of talk of, well, I've been Buddhist for a long time, so therefore I should be able to come. Here then, this course was not set up to be a kind of public venture per se, but rather was set up so as to present, over the course of a number of years, a gradual kind of introduction to each foundation block of the Buddhist teaching. And it would be introduced in such a way that one would know not only the subject objectively, but there would be time to contemplate it, and then running parallel therewith, the practices of mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness and shamatha that we've gone through, would be taught, so that you would have the kind of, through practice then, the kind of ability to focus upon and hold the teachings within our mindfulness or within our mind. So as such, when this kind of course is running, of course, some of the subjects which are going to be taught are going to be quite difficult. So how much more difficult would that be to somebody who hasn't gone through the 2 years kind of preparation for that? As such, the teacher of the more advanced classes, needs then the student to be at a certain level. And this is not something which is bigoted in any way. It's not something which is a kind of one-sided or partial, is rather following the medium of a modern education. Year one, once you've completed year one, you go on to year two, then to year three, then to year four. Similarly, in the university, you finished a BA. Only when you have the BA in hand, you can go into MPhil, MA, PhD. Regardless of, I've been to some MA classes, I want to come to your PhD class. What does that matter? For example, if I'm teaching a PhD course in philosophy, and somebody who's never studied philosophy but nevertheless has studied, let's say, psychology, comes to me and says, "I want to come to your class," I say, "Well, you're not qualified to come to my class." "Yeah, but I did some, you know, MA Phil and some MA courses, MPhil and MA courses in psychology, so, and I know English, which is the language, so therefore, I read a book on it once, so therefore," if such a person kind of who's unprepared for the class comes to the class, one of two things can happen. One is if a lot of unprepared people come to a so-called advanced class, the teacher who's giving the course, or is giving the discourse, then looks at the target audience. If like 3/4 of them really don't know what's going on, he brings the teaching down to their level. If that happens, then those who've been studying really hard for a couple of years are pushed away. And that's wrong, because they've worked really hard to be in this position and want a particular advanced teaching from the teacher. As such, this is not in line with the general idea of the course. If, however, then the teacher recognizes that, focuses on this group, let's say 3/4 or 2/3 of the audience don't know what's going on. And they're confused and they get frustrated and then they kind of walk out, and it ruins the kind of energy, if you like, or the kind of the vibe of the group. As such, then, we made a kind of rule at the beginning that this particular A to Z course is not restrictive in any way, but rather is open to those who want to follow it from the beginning to the end. If one wants to kind of try it out, one is welcome to it. Now, for example, if you really want to kind of join this class, and it does require some commitment, then we've decided to change the kind of procedure a little bit. Of course, one has to listen to all the modules that have gone before, because without listening to them, one will not really know where one is in terms of the teaching. And one, for one's own sake, for the sake of one's own experience, will not get as much out of the discourse, the teaching, as one could. That's one point. So one listens then to the modules that have gone before to kind of prepare oneself, but also listening to things on a MP3 player is rather impersonal. So we also have decided that there are at least three modules given every year by wonderful people such as Geshe Kelso Wamo and Venerable Rita and others. And so these courses then should be kind of interactive with you if you want to follow it. And that is to say, you should get to know the teachers, interact with them, speak with them, kind of discuss your practice, discuss your contemplation. And also, I encouraged the new kind of rule be that if we are following kind of A to Z, then you should at least come to at least one weekend course a year, at least, with a particular teacher, get to know them. And if you can't come to the other two modules, then you should at least follow that by listening to the MP3, and of course contemplating it by yourself. And next year, then we decided that we would, in order to kind of bring everybody up to speed, then we would do kind of a 10 days kind of review. And the 10-day kind of review, maybe next August, wouldn't just be like a kind of dry academic review, but would be quite a strict retreat. And within the retreat, then we would practice analytical meditation, and we would use then the kind of raw instructions on how to draw out the kind of realization or understanding, subjective realization of the subjects that have gone before. But at this point would also mark a cutoff. So the end of 2014 would be like the end of kind of admission to this particular A to Z program. It doesn't mean that we can't start another one, but it's that people who have gone through this course have gone through all the contemplations of a person of lesser and middling capacity, and thereby we would go into the kind of specific Mahayana Buddhism with a Tibetan flavor of Sutra and Tantra both, but primarily then for 1 or 2 years, just reflecting upon then the quintessential features of the Mahayana tradition. And then, of course, that would lead one into the explanation of the Vajrayana, the tradition within which teachers were being invited to give particular empowerments and so forth. Now, I want to say that this is not being kind of exclusive. Rather, it's just the way a modern education faculty runs. Some may have a hard time digesting this, but it's something that we're all familiar with through our education, secular education, through university education, etc., through one class leading into another, building blocks. That's how I think, or I'm sure, in fact, that a genuine kind of spiritual practice can occur through then building a firm foundation through listening to, reflecting upon, and meditation, single-pointedly focusing upon then the realization of these fundamental teachings. And with that as the foundation, then placing the second layer, the third layer, the fourth layer, etc. And the only aim of this kind of program, the only kind of point of it, is to, and fingers crossed, that at the end of, you know, however long it takes, that some people, some within the however 40 or so people are doing the course, have some genuine kind of a spiritual experience. That's the only reason for having it. And as such, I feel particularly kind of protective of those who've really kind of gone out of their way to attend the various courses of the wonderful teachers, Geshe Kelso Wamo and Rita and so on, Geshe and Gengasola and others. The point of it is because if you really kind of put a lot of energy into it, then the course itself, this particular kind of minor feature in the Dharma Friends of Israel, has a responsibility to those kind of students who kind of put them in a position where they can really experience some kind of deep teaching in a way which is kind of like a discussion with teachers such as Geshe Kelso Wamo and Rita and others, and others that will be introduced later on to give various empowerments and things. And these kind of empowerments and more deeper meditation practices, do they work? Yes, they do. well, I don't realize anything. I don't have any kind of super. I don't have any kind of a super experience. How come my mind is still, after 10 years, unable to focus on the image? As my teacher Geshe Wangchen said, at one point, if you add up a column of figures, if there's a mistake made at the beginning, it carries right the way through to the end. The mistake that is often made within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, going right back to what I said at the beginning, is a lack of a foundation in the teaching of the Buddha in general and in the teaching of the Mahayana in specific. If one has this strong foundation, which is brought about through not only listening to the teaching or attempting to meditate on it, but through this rigorous digestion, this rigorous and contemplative practice, then this provides a stable foundation for future realization. And as such, without this, I mean, it makes common sense if you think of it in light of building a house. If you build a house on a shaky ground, like sand or something, it's not going to stay up. If you said to an engineer, please build a mansion on this wet sand, they'll say, you're mad. Oh, you're a kind of eccentric millionaire. Oh, I'll give you $2 billion if you do it now. Okay, fine. But don't expect it to stay up. And more often than not, it will, just with a slight movement, it will collapse. Similarly, when it comes to these seemingly advanced meditation practices, the reason we can't, for example, hold our attention on a particular deity, the reason we can't bring about a kind of sense of all-encompassing kind of bodhicitta, the reason why we cannot hold in the kind of mandala of a particular deity in mind, is because, why? We have no mindfulness, we have no practice of shamatha. That's where the fault lies. We cannot gain a really good practice, we've got something missing, I'm always distracted. Why? Take it back to the foundations of Buddhism. Because we perhaps have not, we do not appreciate our predicament enough. We haven't reflected upon how this particular opportunity is not going to be open to us for a long time. And here we don't need to just to take it on board, because the Buddha said, we use our kind of common sense, use our kind of logic, and above all, discuss with our kind of Dharma friends the particular subject, and thereby increase our understanding, and thereby bring about then some fundamental change within ourselves. So for this to occur, on an ultimate level then, in general, when it comes to the kind of digesting of the teaching of the Buddha, one not only needs to have an understanding, that is to say, using one's intelligence to gain a general overview, but we also need a kind of a magnifying glass through which then the sun's rays can be turned into that which starts fire. Similarly, through understanding the general picture of the teaching of the Buddha, having that as our foundation, we then refine it. We don't refine it to somebody else's constitution. We refine it to our own constitution. It doesn't mean that we bend the teaching. Rather, it means that we bend ourselves so that the teaching kind of merges kind of with us, and thereby we bring about some spiritual kind of experience or spiritual realization. And that which is the catalyst for this to occur is a spiritual teacher. And as such, the subject of our kind of weekend together is then how to rely upon the spiritual teacher. And so I have to say at the beginning that I'm talking in terms of generalities. Now, with regards to the practice of relying upon a spiritual teacher, this then is a subjective practice. If you want to kind of go into the in depth into the teaching of Buddha through the medium of meditation, then one necessarily needs then not only a firm foundation, but also one needs a teacher with whom one can discuss not only the digesting of the teaching in general, but also the practical application to oneself. And as such, the Buddha is renowned as the king of physicians. And similarly then, one relies upon a spiritual teacher like a physician. But that which is in need of healing, if you will, is not the kind of body, but rather is the mind. And that which brings about or kind of naturally induces this healing from within is in the method or the practices of contemplation. And as such, then, when it comes to the practice of relying upon the spiritual teacher, as I mentioned, this is a kind of subjective pursuit, in the sense that not every teacher is for one, you know. There are countless teachers. Well, not so many now, but anyway, there are lots of teachers, but just because one is a teacher, it doesn't mean they have to be your kind of teacher or guru. There is a kind of subjective subject-object, you know, teacher and disciple, teacher and student, guru and disciple, whichever way you look at it, it's the student that makes the teacher. And it is also then the disciple that makes the teacher, once the relationship has formed. But this then we'll discuss more tomorrow. But on the basic level, on the basal level then, one should be open to the idea that in order to bring about kind of stable realization or spiritual transformation, mind training, however you like to call it, within us, it is essential to have then a grounding in the general teaching of the Buddha, and in specific then the Mahayana tradition. And we're very fortunate that within the millennia of Tibetan masters have left us with numerous instruction manuals. As such, when we reflect upon them in light of the general and specific understanding of the teaching of the Buddha, that is to say the Theravada and Mahayana approaches to Buddhism, when we read these instruction manuals and then gain the clarification or the kind of fine-tuning to our constitution from a fully qualified teacher, then there's no doubt that we can bring about the spiritual transformation within us. As such, as last week when we were talking about the practice of mindfulness, the pitfall then of contrived experience is thoroughly negated, because through this fine-tuning under the direction of a skilled physician or teacher, one is then able to bring about a kind of genuine experience oneself. As such, I'll conclude here for this evening, and the main kind of import of what I want to get across is to reflect and to contemplate why it's necessary to have this wide vision, and therewithin to finally hone this to one's own constitution. And the method or the means of finally tuning is provided by then somebody who's trodden that path before, somebody who has the actual experience of what one is trying to experience for oneself, that is to say, a guide, a leader, a teacher, or a spiritual guru. Okay, so I'll finish here for today. And if we go back to then the treasury of blessing, on page 11 is the English. So the conclusion, then we simply recite, the miraculous display of the unsurpassable wisdom appears as the intentions, deeds, power, knowledge, love, and ability of all the Sugatas and their offspring. May all beings become exactly like them. And then the dedication as usual.